A Different Kind of Leader captures insights from diverse leaders in healthcare, public health, and academic settings so that our organizations are in a stronger position to grow, innovate, and meet the challenges of our day. To our listeners, thanks so much for joining us.
I'm so excited to be joined by my friend and colleague, Sam Saha. Sam is a general internist at the VA Portland Healthcare System. He's a practicing primary care and hospital medicine physician at the VA for the last 25 years. He's also a professor of medicine and public health at the Oregon Health and Science University, OHSU. Sam has done so much. His research has really focused on the influence of race and ethnicity in the doctor-patient relationship and how that relates to racial disparities in the quality of care and its implications for diversity in the healthcare workforce. He has been recognized by our professional home, the Society of General Internal Medicine, and the AAMC for this work. And he has really shaped policy, serving for over 10 years as the chair of the Oregon Health Services Commission and Health Evidence Review Commission. These groups are charged with prioritizing health services, developing evidence-based guidelines, and guiding coverage policy for Oregon's public insurance programs. Sam, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Giselle.
So, as you know, we start every interview asking for a quote from our guest. What is a quote that embodies your leadership style or your approach to your career or that has been a source of inspiration for you?
Yeah, I looked at this and I thought, I know you were going to ask me that. And so I thought, like, let me find a quote. And then I thought, like, why would I go out and find a quote? The point is to actually give a quote that I carry with me. So the problem is that I don't know actually where this quote originated. I think I first read it in Stephen Covey's Seven Habits book, but I can't be sure that that's true or that it's his quote. And I can't actually give the quote straight out. But the gist of the thing that I carry with me when I think about both leadership and sort of choices in my career is that success, or winning the game, if you will, is defined by three things. One is doing something you truly care about, that you're deeply passionate about. The second is finding something that you are uniquely suited to do, that you can do particularly well. And the third is that what you do should contribute something good to the world. And if you find the thing that where you hit all three of those buttons, you have won the game. And I read that 20 years ago, and I've sort of carried it with me for the last two decades.
I love that whole framing. And I read Stephen Covey's book actually when I was a junior faculty member. I felt like I needed to get a robe and like walk around because I felt like I was like an evangelist of Stephen Covey at some point. It was so transformative to read his book and to really, it sort of centers what's important as you approach your work and your life, really. So yeah, thanks for sharing that. I'm not sure if it was from Stephen Covey's book. At one point I had memorized that book, but it's a wonderful sentiment. I mean, it definitely seems like it's in keeping with some of his work. So tell me about how you got started in medicine. Tell me sort of your early beginnings and then maybe share with us some of your leadership journey.
Well, I will tell you that my trip into medicine was somewhat not thought out very well. There are two things to note about my upbringing. One is that I was the son of two physicians. The second is that they were both Asian. So I had two Asian physician parents, which essentially, I think anybody who's listening to this who grew up in the same environment means you will be a physician too.
What kind of doctor will you be?
That is exactly right. That is the question that was asked of me when I was 3 years old. Not, you know, will you become a physician? It's like, do you want to be a physician like your mom or your dad? So I grew up in hospitals and clinics. I was, you know, kind of babysat by nurses while my parents did rounds. It was never questioned that I was going to be a physician. And I just sort of, I don't know, somehow I just internalized that. And I got to college and sort of just blindly went through the pre-med curriculum, blindly applied to medical schools without ever sort of stopping to think, is this really what I want to do? And then I got to my third year of medical school. I was midway through my third year, and I had been a good student all my life. I could sort of just do school pretty well. And then when I got to third year of medical school, that's when you're not in school anymore. You're out on the wards, you're out seeing patients. And I thought, like, well, I'm not good at this. I'm good at books. And I sort of found myself kind of flailing around in deep water and thought, like, oh my gosh, I don't know that this is for me. I don't know that I want to do this. And I started questioning whether I wanted to continue. I actually started thinking about what else I wanted to do. I'm very into food, so I sort of contemplated a career as a chef. I actually got several applications to cooking school.
I knew you were into food. I didn't know it went this far.
Oh, yeah. I actually filled out a couple of applications. None of this was disclosed to my parents because, you know, again, the Asian parenting thing. So I then took a pause, took a deep breath, and said, like, you know, maybe I should think about this. I took a little break from medical school where I planned a 6-month tour of duty in different parts of Asia. So I went to Calcutta and I went to Thailand and I went to Beijing and these were all planned kind of medical rotations, but mostly it was a time for me to think and have a break. And during that period, I sort of came to the realization that 3.5 years into medical school is not the time to quit, that there's a small stretch remaining to get an MD degree that you've worked a long time to get. And that I think I realized at that point that getting an MD didn't mean necessarily doing what I was doing that I wasn't really enjoying. You could do anything with an MD, and why give up the chance to get it? So I went back with sort of renewed purpose and finished medical school. And then I hit internship. And what I discovered about myself was that once I got to be a real doctor, meaning I actually had an MD, and I wasn't really being graded like I was in third and fourth year, I actually loved it. I loved seeing patients. I loved taking care of people. I loved the whole game. I mean, everything about it I loved. And so I was very grateful that I had sort of taken that pause and thought about, you know, other possibilities, taking what I was doing and thinking through alternatives within that space as opposed to just ditching it. And then eventually when I got to the stage of kind of being out of school, as it were, I truly enjoyed it and I stuck with it. And then I ended up then, I think, in the career that I'm in, where I am a clinician, I do see patients, but I do it part-time and spend a lot of my time teaching and doing research. And that has been great. It's been a fabulous career. And I think, you know, at the time that I was sort of contemplating leaving medicine, I never envisioned that this was a possibility. And so one of the things I learned from all of that is, you know, when you find yourself in a moment of crisis or wondering if you're in the right place, always think about sort of alternatives within the space you're in, as opposed to just abandoning ship.
That's so powerful. And I wondered if you could have thought back on your journey and connected it to the sort of the way that you framed your quote. And maybe you could say a little bit about that in terms of purpose, things you're good at.
Yeah. So I think that one of the moments that I sort of realized what I might be good at, because I thought, you know, I was pretty good at, when I was in residency, I thought I was pretty good at this. I'm competent. I'm in a decent residency program and functioning well, but there are lots of people that did what I did. And a thing that happened to me when I was in my residency was that I had an elective block and I decided on the recommendation of one of my clinic attendings to take a course in clinical epidemiology. And it was a course that was taught to fellows, but the professor said, yeah, sure, you can take this class, because at the time I was planning to do a research project with this clinic attending mentor of mine. And he said, you know, you'll learn a lot from this guy. And I went and I took this class and I found that, first of all, I just loved it to pieces. I mean, our text was the Sackett and Haynes clinical epidemiology book, and I read it like a novel. I was just sort of so wrapped up in the math and the puzzle solving, and because that was sort of, you know, kind of, I'm a very left brain person. And then I found that when I would go to the class and I would sort of do the assignments, I did really well. Like, I was actually outperforming these fellows who were in a 2-year program dedicated to learning this stuff. And the professor actually approached approached me afterwards and he told me, like, you're good at this. You ought to think about this. And that was the first time that I thought, sort of started thinking, like, maybe I should do a fellowship and train to do this stuff because I like it. I'm good at it. So that was sort of where I think I sort of found that, like, hey, there's something I'm good at that maybe I should listen to. I should listen to that signal. And then that was about the same time when I was sort of like, I had this kind of, this was in my mid-20s, I think, and I had this sort of moment of kind of, I think I just sort of grew up. I think they say adolescence goes from 15 to 25. I think I was emerging from my delayed adolescence. And around that time, I came into this realization that I had been absorbing for my whole life a lot of racism that I didn't even realize I was absorbing. I had sort of gone through my youth. I grew up in the suburban Midwest. I was the only brown person for 20 miles. And I dealt with a lot of racism when I was a kid. I'd sort of swallowed. I didn't even know that I was absorbing it. It was just normal. It was just, you know, the little
water.
Offhand comments. It was, it was just, yeah, that's right. What's water? Yeah, I didn't even realize that this was abnormal. And it went through college. And then I got to med school. And I sort of ran into a crowd that was a lot more progressive, a lot more diverse. And all of a sudden, sort of, you know, the water was different. And I realized, like, oh my gosh, that, you know, the comments have disappeared. These friends don't make those comments. And then I started to realize what I'd been absorbing for 25 years. And frankly, I got angry. I got really angry in my mid-20s and angry at what I had been tolerating my whole life. And around the same time, a couple of things happened. One is that as I was sort of looking for research projects to do with this mentor, I ran across a whole literature that said that minorities got worse care than white people, and that made me angrier. And right around that same time, this was when I was a resident, California was contemplating banning affirmative action, and they did. Liberal, progressive California became the first state in the country to ban affirmative action, and that made me super angry. And so all these things sort of conspired, and I sort of channeled that anger into what has become my career.
Yeah.
I think I really sort of, it was just at a moment in time when everything converged and sort of showed me the path that I needed to go on. So,
so much in what you just said. The first that really resonated for me is the draw of clinical epidemiology. When Alvin Feinstein and Ralph Horowitz sort of came up to me as a chief resident and said, why don't you sit in on our clin epi primer that we're giving? And I was just kind of blown away about the way to think about the world to address the sort of systematic inequalities that I was seeing through as a resident. And then that anger when you realize, wait a minute, this is not just my experience. This is so many other people's experiences. And I've been able to sort of survive this because of who I have on, you know, Team Giselle and my family. But there's so many other people that haven't been able to be successful. How did you move through that anger? So many people get stuck in that and it can actually be pretty corrosive.
I think I was surrounded by people who, at the time, that I could sort of vent that anger with in a productive way. And, you know, I was in San Francisco in the mid-90s, and I had come into a clutch of friends totally really by accident, but these are just people that I liked. But they, as opposed to my whole life up to that point, where most of my friends were white men, I had this incredibly diverse clutch of people that I was surrounded by who kind of, I don't know, helped me kind of would listen when I would get mad and would say, like, yeah, me too, right? And so my tribe really helped to get through it. And then I think also when I sort of realized, like, I care about this and I have dealt with what I now realize is injustice, and this lights a fire in me. So, like, the anger turned into, like, an enthusiasm to sort of, it gave me a sense of purpose that just was actually intoxicating. I thought, like, well, this is, like, I've found what I want to do. I went through, as I described, I went through and I decided I was going to become a doctor, and I liked it and I was good at it. But then when I found this, I thought, like, this is not just something I'm good at, but I deeply care about. And then there's the third Covey criteria of contributing to the world. And I thought that was an easy checkbox. So yeah, I think it sort of channeling the anger into an energy, that where the energy of the anger can be channeled productively into work to make things right and make things better. That's sort of how I got through it. Not to say that it wasn't, you know, I didn't go through a little bit of depression about how much I tolerated and absorbed. I was, there was a lot of sort of self-critical, like, how could you have not stood up for yourself? But then I exerted a little self-compassion and went on my way.
Well, that's far more productive than when Mott Dawning, that realization hit me. I just kept going around in my residency calling out racism. and I got pulled aside. I said, and one of the attendings came over, pulled me aside and asked to meet with me. And she's like, you know, you gotta be careful that you don't sound like an angry Black woman. Which I actually thought was hilarious because she was the angriest white woman I had ever met. She was calling it out just as much as I was. So it was actually, I think Carrie Rockamore in her book, The Black Academic's Guide to Winning Tenure Without Losing Your Soul, talks about this idea of dealing when you're confronted. And I think what you describe is sort of a beautiful way to move through it, that you can, that there's some moving from habits of survival to sort of practices in terms of thriving. And the habits of survival are sort of shoving it down, or going around screaming at people, which, you know, which is what I did. Or you can be or you can be intentional and sort of exert the control that, about in terms of who you are, and be intentional about the way you address it, either not shoving it down, but making a conscious decision about how and when you're going to address whatever you think it needs to be. So, yeah.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I will say that, like, you know, it, I had the, maybe the benefit of being, even though I'm a brown person, I am, you know, I think what I refer to as an overrepresented minority in medicine. My people are like walking the halls of every hospital in America. And so it is the, it might have been, it's a different experience. You know, not that like it's good experience that I had growing up, but it's a different experience, and maybe one where it might have been easier for me to sort of dig myself out of the anger hole than it might have been for you or for others that don't have doctor parents and lots of examples of people who are in the same shoes that you are. So
maybe I think that's a generous explanation. I think I don't know. I think I've always just been a little bit happy too. So you are now shaping policy in Oregon around health services. How did you come into doing that work? What was the path that got you there?
Yeah. So I will say that I had to step down after 14. Well, I gladly stepped down. I was on that commission. So we were called the Health Services Commission until 2012. I was on the Health Service Commission from 2004 to 2012. And then we sort of changed our name and expanded our scope and became the Health Evidence Review Commission. And at that point, I became the inaugural chair and was there for the next 6 or 7 years, way exceeding my term. But I love the work. And the way that I got into it is that part of the reason that I actually ended up in Oregon, because, you know, I went to do my fellowship and I was very focused by then on topic of race and ethnicity and diversity in medicine. And then I moved to Portland, Oregon. And I think it's, you know, it's not lost on people that that's a weird thing to do. You're studying racial disparities and you're moving to the whitest city in America. Part of it was just kind of, that's where there was a job that where there were supportive people. And for family reasons, that was a good place for us. But part of it was that Oregon was doing these amazing things in healthcare. Little Oregon, we have, frankly, the state of Oregon is smaller than most major cities in the United States. But when it comes to health and health policy, Oregon is way out in front in many ways. And one of the things that they were doing in Oregon, starting just a few years before I got here, was explicitly rationing healthcare. And we were the first state to do it. We were one of the first places in the world to do it. And although there was a lot of bad press about it, although there were a lot of ethicists screaming and yelling that we were violating all ethical rules, it made perfect sense to me. It was based on a simple principle, which is that we should try to cover everybody, not everything. And that it, when the choice came between, when funds were short and the choice came between covering everybody for fewer things or covering everything for fewer people, we should choose the former. We should try to cover everybody in the vein of equity. And I think, like, at that point, I had sort of become, equity had been pumping through my blood so strongly that this idea just smacked of good sense. So part of my reason to come to Oregon was to be involved in that world. And then at some point, I was a junior faculty member. I'd been on faculty for like, I think 3 or 4 years. And one of my mentors who knew that I liked this idea and had involved me in a bunch of evidence-based medicine stuff. We have an evidence-based practice center here, and I got involved in the evidence-based practice center and learned a few things about evidence and cost effectiveness. And that gave me sort of an entree into this field of kind of evidence-based policy. So someone called me once and said, hey, do you want to be on this health services commission? And I sort of, you know, this was part of the reason I moved to Oregon. So I jumped on, and then I really sort of put my heart and soul into it. Then I chaired the commission, and then I stayed on for longer than maybe I should have. But it was really just incredibly intoxicating work. You got to basically take healthcare services, because what we did was we ranked services on a prioritized list. So we have a list of services ranked from the most important to the least important. And our job on this commission was to take the evidence and to figure out where to put things on the list. Do we cover this? Do we not cover this? And how high do we prioritize this particular service? And so new services are coming, new technologies are coming through all the time. Old technologies are getting better. Some technologies are fading out of practice. And our job was to take these things and figure out what the evidence said about them. So I got to use my sort of skills in epidemiology and evidence-based medicine and apply them to a system of care that had equity at its root. And so that was just, it just hit all my buttons.
Yeah, that's heady stuff.
It was heady stuff.
Oh, and my gosh.
And I got to kind of steer that ship for, you know, a decade. And what was really sort of beautiful about it is that a lot of it was just wonky work. I mean, we were sifting through ICD-9 codes and CPT codes, and that was not such, you know, fun. But underneath it all was the idea that we were trying to conscientiously use our resources to cover what was evidence-based, what worked, and what was of high value, and try to deprioritize those things that were of low value, all in the interest of making sure that we covered as many people as possible. So it used a lot of my experience and my expertise. I really loved it. I cared deeply about it. And I think it contributed some good to the world. And our model, we would sort of go to this little conference room and every month, and we would meet and we would deliberate over different healthcare services. And we would do our little, you know, we were just a little group doing our little work, but, you know, we were sort of a model. I think it was interesting to me when I first started, I thought, you know, I'm interested in this, but I wonder, you know, I didn't know that everybody else was. And we would have like, we had a delegation from China, a delegation from Germany. We had people coming from the UK, from New Zealand. I mean, everybody wanted to know what Oregon was doing. And so being at the center of that was one of the highlights of my career. Yeah, it was fantastic work. And all of it was, you know, it was primarily targeted at our Medicaid program. So most of it was about sort of keeping as many people on Medicaid as possible. And so knowing that we were sort of doing it in the interest of trying to take care of people who really were most vulnerable and most needed our services also was an energy infusing aspect of the whole thing.
Do you have any thoughts about Medicaid transformation in North Carolina? We're in the midst of it now. Anything from your experience, vast experience in Oregon, that you would, key points that you think anybody that's contemplating Medicaid transformation, either in North Carolina or any other place, might want to hear?
I don't know. I think, I mean, I lived in one little small space of the Medicaid world, which was kind of the benefits, is shaping the benefits package. But I think, you know, being in that world, I did sort of see everything else that was happening in Oregon with our Medicaid program. And, you know, we have been doing for the last several years an experiment in Oregon. It's called the CCO experiment, the Coordinated Care Organization experiment, which is basically kind of, we split the state into 16 regional authorities, and each region has its own governance. And basically through a waiver that our governor at the time obtained from President Obama, they get to sort of do Medicaid the way they want. They don't have to follow the traditional fee-for-service mm-hmm. type rules or even managed care rules. So I think one of the things that has been beautiful about it is that our Medicaid program is allowed to cover things that aren't on the CPT list. So the pitch that our governor always gave and that he gave to President Obama in the White House, was this patient. This was a story. Everybody that knows John Kitzhaber knows this story. There was a patient of his when he was practicing emergency medicine 30 years ago who used to come to the emergency department twice a month, get admitted several times a year, apparently. And she had just very bad asthma. And he would always say that he was always allowed to admit her for the $4,000 hospitalization and all of the, you know, inhalers and nebulizers and such that she needed. But he could never get her the $400 air conditioner that would have kept her out of the emergency department. And so he basically said, like, let us pay for the air conditioner. And that's what he got. He got a waiver to say, we're going to give you a global budget, do what you want with it. I think like anybody that's doing Medicaid, any kind of healthcare transformation, but Medicaid transformation in particular, where I think, you know, social determinants are such a huge part of what drives people's health and health and healthcare use, let people address the social determinants. Don't just restrict people to you to addressing medical determinants. Let people take care, let people fund. We now have several of our CCOs are paying for community health workers, which is not a traditionally billable service. But I think that the allowing people to get creative about addressing social determinants is sort of like the cutting edge of Medicaid transformation.
Yeah. The whole idea of even a broader view of our healthcare workforce in terms of community health workers not only addresses sort of the immediate need of patients and providers, really, but it also creates this pathway to other medical professions, right? I mean, there's in my community partners that we work with, they all have talked about what it has meant to be so close to research and the possibilities that they have seen for themselves in terms of their own higher education.
I think nowadays, as we are trying to like work our way out of the opioid crisis, people will sort of poo-poo the ideas of, you know, these alternative therapies that people use for pain. You know, do they work? Are they just placebo? Well, for God's sake, placebo is better than opioids.
So okay.
If a placebo works, it's a lot better than oxycodone. So
exactly.
To pay for it.
Exactly. Get that 30% response rate. What are your sources of inspiration? You've talked about that realization of health inequalities being so transformative for you in terms of your work. Now, what are your sources of inspiration now in terms of your work?
Well, I think a couple of things. One is that I'm at a stage of my life where, and my career, where I'm aware that I'm on the downslope of the hill. There's a great article that a friend recently sent me. It's from The Atlantic from this past summer. It's written by a guy, I think his name's Arthur Brooks, and he used to be the president of the American Enterprise Institute, which is a kind of a neoconservative think tank, almost no opinion of which I agree with. But this guy wrote an article that really just has stuck with me about career trajectories and what happens when you hit 50. And I think one of the things that he makes, the thread of the article is basically, you know, at our stage, you know, the creative neurons are, they're on their way out. And the most, your chance at the greatest innovation and creative ideas were in your 30s.
Oh, wow. I wish I knew that in my 30s.
I know. I'm trying to tell everybody in their 30s, you got to read this article. Because I tell all my mentees now that, you know, just really, you got to like go for broke because it's all downhill after this. But I think one of the points he makes was that what you do have to offer, if you know you're not, your mind isn't sort of buzzing with new ideas, is wisdom. And so these days, I sort of realize that, you know, maybe I'm over the hill, but the people that I mentor, the young people that I get to work with, are on the upslope. And I, from, you know, having been to the top of whatever hill I climbed, can really kind of help guide those people up the hill. So I think, you know, one of my inspirations now is to like look for young people who were like me when I was their age and really kind of do whatever I can to pave their path and give them some guidance, because they're the ones with the ideas, they're the ones with the energy, but I've walked that road and I can help them walk it. So that's not to say that I've given up on my own ideas. These days, I'm very kind of interested in looking at how our biases creep into healthcare. And so I think, you know, a lot of people talk about unconscious bias. It's become a very hot topic. And then people sort of talk about it as, you know, one of the root causes of disparities in the care we deliver. But it's very difficult to sort of tease out like how it works, how it happens. And so I've been getting into work to look very carefully at sort of how people talk to each other and do these kind of really cool kind of computerized linguistic analyses. My research partner and I have been doing research looking at medical records. It turns out that medical records are a place where doctors tend to just let their biases escape pretty liberally. And if you read medical records, it's astounding how much bias you'll see. So looking at sort of how our biases, the biases that we know we all have, creep into healthcare and how they, the pathway through which they actually do influence the care people get, I'm very interested in sort of teasing that out and trying to nip it in the bud.
That's really exciting. That's so cool. The part I'm not so good with is the 50 being over the hill, though. I think I'm not okay with that.
Oh, you gotta read this article. It's actually a liberating article, Giselle, I will tell you. You gotta read it. It's an Atlantic article, so there's like a cartoon that goes with it. The cartoon, basically, you'll look at it and you'll say, I don't want to read this. This is like, basically, it shows a person at the top of a staircase where they're 50, and then they're looking at the steep slope down. And I looked at it and I thought, I don't want to read this, but it is actually a very liberating article. You read it and you realize how life is actually going to get better for us.
Okay. All right. Well, I'll read it, but I'm still, still not going to like it. Tell you that right now.
Well, actually, the one thing is that the one silver lining is that we are in a world, academia in particular, where old people actually have, we have more longevity than most other. This, God help the people in the tech industry. Once
That's
they hit
true.
40, they're out. They're out.
So true. That is so true. That, yes. Okay, so I'll be okay with the article. I'm going to transition us to the questions we ask all of our guests at the end. So you talked a little bit about food, but what are some of your hobbies? What do you do for self-care?
Yeah. Well, so like I do love food and I love to cook. So I'm not a professional cook, but God, I mean, my perfect sort of Sunday afternoon is just spending the whole day in the kitchen and chopping and stirring and making a meal for the evening. And it's just, it is sort of like my meditative space kitchen. So
what did you make the last three Sundays?
Ooh, the last three Sundays. On a recent Sunday, my favorite recent Sunday where I spent the whole day in the kitchen, I made a bolognese. And it was just, it's this thing that takes about 5 hours of simmering and stirring, and it fills the house with this beautiful aroma. And then it turns into this like ridiculously rich and beautiful sauce that just everybody loves. And yeah, that was one. I think I recently roasted a big piece of pork. I rubbed it with garlic and rosemary and then roasted it and served it with a bunch of root vegetables. And we always have leftovers when I roast a pork, and then we made cubanos for lunch the next day.
If I ate meat, I would be very excited about that.
I have been eating a lot less meat, and I'm now getting into grains because there are so, like, bulgur and farro and all these grains, like I can't, there are restaurants that make it well and they really make me happy. I have a meditation mat and cushion in my room and I try to meditate, although I find meditation so relaxing and intoxicating that I tend to sort of overdo it and I just stay there for too long. So, which is a problem because then I don't do it as much because I don't have time. But as soon as I sit down to meditate, I feel so good that I let myself just sit there for a long time. I need to really get into the practice of the 5-minute meditation because otherwise I'm just never going to get to it.
What's your favorite leadership book or a book that you'd recommend to others?
Yeah, so a book that I have found, I listened to on Audible, and as soon as I was done, I listened to it again because I thought like this was really like I need this message pounded into me, is a book called Essentialism. I think it's a relatively new book. It's by a guy named Greg McKeown. He's a guy from Scotland that basically he was in law school and he realized like, I don't want to do this. And then he basically made the hard choice of actually leaving. So instead of doing what I did and persisting and then figuring out what he wanted to do, he actually just pivoted and basically does a lot of consulting for for leaders in business. But he wrote a book, it's called Essentialism, and I think the subtitle is Discipline Pursuit of Less. And the entire book is about finding your thing and focusing. And the principle is basically when we become successful, when we acquire leadership opportunities and we become successful, more people request things of us, there are more demands on our time, and we feel like kind of we get into this groove of like, aren't I so important, you know, and we sort of start doing all these things. And also we want to be good citizens. And so we give of ourselves to all these different tasks and we think we can do it all. And then his point is that the problem with that is that the more you take on, the thinner you spread yourself. And the thinner you spread yourself, the less impact you have. And if you continue in that mode, you will actually phase yourself out of being that valuable person that everybody wants their time, because you will not be as impactful if you don't focus your efforts and make your mark in very limited ways. You're going to just be this person that nobody wants to go to anymore, because you're going to dilute your impact over time by basically spreading yourself too thin. And so it's a lot about focus. It's a lot about saying no to things. It's a lot about deliberating about what you choose. He uses an analogy of like clothes in the closet and how we often keep clothes in our closet that we don't wear. When it comes to cleaning out the closet, we never throw those things out because we think, oh, I might wear that someday. His sort of advice is like, if you don't wear it, get rid of it. So like if it's not providing you, if it doesn't meet those three criteria, and I think he actually uses those three things that I talked about as sort of a guiding framework. If they don't meet those three things, they got to go. And he sort of says things like, if it's not hell yes, then it's a no. Anyway, so that I just finished sabbatical. So I was on sabbatical for 6 months. And part of my sabbatical kind of mindset was taking the opportunity now that I'm at that stage of my 50s and looking at the next 20 years and sort of, you know, kind of really thinking hard about how I want to spend my time. And that book really crystallized, I think, kind of, it really resonated with me, kind of focusing on the things that you most care about and limiting yourself so that you're not spreading yourself too thin is a super important concept if you want to continue to sort of make a difference in the world.
Yeah, that sounds like a really incredible book. I'm going to be adding that to my Audible list in a little bit. Yeah.
Yeah, it's very good. Yeah. Easy to listen to, yeah. He's got a Scottish accent. It's very smooth.
Oh, so that's even more fun. Definitely an Audible book.
That's right.
What do you think separates good leaders from great leaders?
I think firm adherence to principles and priorities. I think that there are people who are very talented, who are good with people, even who have vision. But I think that the great leaders are the ones who have a sort of clear, unapologetic platform of principles and priorities that serve as a pillar that everybody can sort of latch onto. I think a lot of people can compromise principles in the interest of, you know, this or that. But I think compromising principles basically always sort of leads to, you know, kind of losing your way. And I know that it sounds kind of simple, but I think I've seen too many people who do stray from their own principles and aren't clear about what the principles are. I think a good leader basically articulates, these are the sort of non-negotiables. This is what we care about. This is what we're going to prioritize. And then everybody who's following that leader knows where they stand. They know exactly what's a yes, what's a no, which direction were we going. And also, I think principles are inspiring. People who adhere to strong principles attract people who believe in those principles and are inspired. And I think being able to inspire the people underneath you is super important. You don't want to just have people working with you or for you. You want to actually inspire them and give them the energy to like really commit their best selves.
Yeah, that's incredibly powerful. And it's, again, goes back to the, probably even that whole framing goes back to the way, the kinds of principles that you had to have or had to be clear about, actually, when you were making decisions about health services in Oregon. I mean, that you had to have a principled approach to that.
Yeah. Well, and I will tell you that, like, I mean, it took me a while. I was shaky when I was younger. When I was first doing my fellowship and I was going to study racial disparities and really work in that space, there were plenty of people who said, like, you're playing at the margins. You are, you know, you're talking about whether people, whether quality of care is met 60% versus 50% when the big gap is between the 60 and the 100. So, like, you should be working. This was in the 90s when, you know, the quality of care movement was in full swing and people really said, like, you know, hey, we've got a quality of care problem in the United States. The disparities thing is just like you're playing at the margins. And a lot of people said it. And it made me really question what I was doing. And I remember sort of being apologetic sometimes about, you know, the work that I did and like, oh yeah, I do this stuff on disparity. And it took me a while to, I think, get to a place where I had to firm up my own principles. And the principle of equity trumped everything. It was just, you know, you can believe what you believe. I believe in equity. But it took me a long time to get there. It took a little maturing to get there. So
in that vein, what advice would you give to your younger self?
Yeah, well, I guess the obvious thing is believe in yourself and stand by your principles. But I think the real thing I would tell myself, my younger self, is stop comparing yourself to other people. I spent a long time in my earlier life. Frankly, I still do it. I still stray and sort of compare myself to other people. But it's a fool's game. I mean, I think the advice I would have is just know who you are, know what you believe in, and follow that. Set your own standard. There's no reason to look around and follow someone else's path or try to chase their success. Just look forward, set your own path, and walk it. You don't need to look around so much.
Sam, this was such an awesome interview. Thank you so
much. Fun.
It was so much fun.
So much fun. God, thank you so much. Thank you for just doing. Thank you for inventing this thing.
You have been listening to A Different Kind of Leader. If you like what you have heard, please rate us and leave a comment wherever you listen to podcasts. It helps others find us. Also, look for us on Facebook and Instagram at Different Kind of Leader, as well as Twitter at DK Leadership. You can also email us at differentkindofleader@gmail.com. Please let us know what leadership questions you have for our guests and which inspiring leaders you would like for us to interview next.